Welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan and Sudan this Wednesday, August 7, 2024. Human Rights Watch is calling on the international community to get serious on Sudan.
Well, we've been calling for the deployment of a civilian protection mission to Sudan for several months now. We first made the call when we released a report looking into ethnic cleansing in West Darfur State back in April.
And Sudan Air Force bombed Kortumbak village in Upper Nile State. We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Authorities in South Sudan say Sudan Air Force bombed a village in Maban County of South Sudan's Upper Nile State. Officials in Maban say two jet fighters belonging to the Sudan Air Force bombed Kortumbak village on Tuesday, causing panic among residents, including refugees from Sudan. This program called the spokesperson of the South Sudan People's Defense Force, General Rul Roy Kwong, for comments, but he did not pick our several calls this past hour. The Human Rights Watch has accused rival forces in Sudan of committing serious crimes against women and girls. Latia Badr, Human Rights Director for Horn of Africa, says there is no place for the culture of impunity in Sudan, adding that the United Nations should deploy protection force in Sudan to deter more abuses across the country.
Well, this research, which looks into the trends of sexual violence in the capital, Khartoum, since the beginning of the conflict through to February this year, is basically primarily based on interviews with service providers, so with doctors, psychologists, lawyers, but also members of what are called the local emergency response rooms, which are basically local volunteers, some of the medical workers, who are trying to respond to the massive needs of the civilian population in Sudan right now. Speaking to them, we basically looked into what sort of cases, what survivors of sexual violence were coming forward to them, what were they telling them about the sort of abuses they had faced, but also what were the medical and psychosocial needs that the survivors were showing or were asking for. And the findings are really quite devastating. What we find was that the rapid support forces in particular, who controlled most of the parts of Khartoum and also its two sister cities, committed widespread sexual violence against women and girls. And this is both rape and also gang rape. We also found that the RSF were forcing women, but also girls, into marriage.
What came out from your research is some of the recommendations, and one recommendation that caught my eye, Human Rights Watch is asking for deployment of intervention force, UN intervention force in Khartoum. How possible is that?
Well, we've been calling for the deployment of a civilian protection mission to Sudan for several months now. We first made the call when we released a report looking into ethnic cleansing in West Darfur State back in April, and we have continued to call for this. It's very clear from our research in Darfur, now this new research in Khartoum, that nowhere is safe for civilians right now in Sudan. And what's also clear is there has been a complete protection vacuum, which has been left basically going back several years to when the Security Council decided to withdraw the AU-UN peacekeeping forces from Darfur. It's very clear that decision was premature. But even last year, when the Security Council decided to follow the decision by the Sudanese Armed Forces allied officials who called for the end of the UN political mission. Now, that political mission wasn't a peacekeeping force, but it did contain important mandate on issues around monitoring of protection of civilian issues. So right now we have nothing in its place. And so what we're calling for is for the UN. Now, there has been a UN Peace, Security Council resolution which has called on the Secretary General to come up with a civilian protection plan for Sudan. We also know that the AU Peace and Security Council has called for a similar plan. So what we're saying is these two bodies need to work together, and states now need to support and roll out a plan to ensure there are civilian protection forces on the ground in Sudan, because the needs are undoubtedly there.
Talk to me about what you are hearing from your contacts on the ground on what is happening in areas controlled by Sudan Armed Forces, because it appears like your report focused more on the alleged atrocities committed by RSF. What about areas where the Sudan Army is in full control?
Well, what we did find was that when the Sudanese Armed Forces retook control of Omdurman, for example, one of the sister cities of Khartoum, we started to receive reports of an uptake in cases of sexual violence, including gang rape by the Sudanese Armed Forces. I mean, what we also describe in this report is the impact of what is a de facto blockade imposed by the Sudanese Armed Forces on all areas of Khartoum, which are controlled by the RSF. So what that means is there has been only a trickle of aid, including medical supplies, being allowed into the capital. So these are millions of people who are cut off from assistance because of the policies of the Sudanese Armed Forces. So the conduct of both warring parties is basically impeding civilians, and these are violations of international humanitarian law. What we also found was that both parties are attacking medical workers and are attacking local responders as well, which do amount to war crimes.
Talk to me about the level of intervention in Sudan. Since April 15 last year, aid agencies, the United Nations Security Council, human rights watchdogs like you have been calling on the international community to do something. How would you describe the level of intervention to put an end to these atrocities that are going unabated?
The efforts by the international and regional community were, I mean, in many ways, largely inexistent. We saw a bit of an increase, I would say, in attention to Sudan at the one-year anniversary, both with the holding of humanitarian conferences to increase the humanitarian funding, because it is willfully underfunded. We've seen also, as I mentioned earlier, a bit more, I would say, concrete calls at the level of the Security Council and the AU Peace and Security Council on critical issues around protection of civilians and human rights abuses. But we've really not seen Sudan at any point being given the sort of attention and political focus which is necessary to halting the horrific abuses which we continue to document to date.
That's Latia Bird, the Human Rights Director for the Horn of Africa. She spoke with me this past hour. Africa has seen an unparalleled surge of protests this year. 2024 has come to represent the growing dissatisfaction of millions who want comprehensive changes, increased political accountability, and better living standards, among them Nigeria's and bad governance protest, Uganda's anti-corruption rallies, Tunisia's down with dictatorship protest, and Kenya's anti-tax bill demonstrations. For more on what such protests mean, VOA's Douglas Mpugo reached political analyst David Monda, who is a professor of political science at City University of New York.
I think the protests have to be looked at in terms of their own unique individual context, because the issues are different in different countries. So whether it's Tunisia, you know, whether it's Uganda, Kenya, Nigeria, and so on. But I think the overriding theme here is bad governance. And I think the citizens not wanting to be treated as subjects, but wanting to be treated as citizens, meaning subjects have to accept whatever the ruler says. The autocrat can rule outside of the limits of other arms of government. But citizens around the continent are saying the governance systems just are not working and we need a different system. And I think this is part of the issue why you see a lot of these demonstrations across the continent.
Predominantly, these protests have been led by the youth. Does that strike you as odd, or maybe it's the attempt, given Africa has the youth, the youngest population?
That is very different from previous protests, because, for example, in the Kenyan context, the figureheads have mainly been opposition politicians. You know, in Uganda, we had, Bobi Wine, we have Kizza Besigye. You know, in Nigeria, before you had the opposition figures challenging President Tinubu. But right now, like in the case of Nigeria, remember there was the protest against police executions. And then more recently, the protest against the poor governance of the Tinubu administration. And then in Kenya now, you have protests around the raising of the taxes, right? The finance bill 2024. The courts have recently annulled the finance bill for 2023. So that's another huge issue. I think the ripple effects of the protests in Kenya, that flu of protests also affected Uganda, which is the neighbor, you know, right across. And I think, again, the context of Uganda is somewhat different. It's a governance issue, but poor governance around, you know, a leader overstaying his welcome. You know, opposition figures are arrested in anticipatory arrest for crimes they've not even committed, but which the government suspects they're going to commit, which is a constitutional violation. So just this whole range of crisis, I think the youth are looking and saying, Africa deserves better, and I Africa needs different systems. I think these protests are only going to get louder, and they're going to get bigger.
And they don't seem to be stopping soon, because there are even threats of some protests in Zimbabwe during the SADC conference. How do you see all this ending up? What can they achieve, these protests?
So this is a good question. Protests will have different outcomes in different contexts. We had a lot of euphoria around the Arab Spring, for example, in North Africa. And there was this big move of the autocrats being removed, military dictatorship being removed, Ben Ali being deposed in Tunisia, Mubarak being toppled in Egypt. And there was this hope that, you know, there was going to be change. But lo and behold, we've had another autocrat reinstate himself in Tunisia, and we have the same old military government under al-Sisi in Egypt. So I think the protests really would depend on how organized civil society is in the different countries.
That's analyst David Monda, political science professor at City University in New York. He spoke to my colleague Douglas Mpogwa. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up, Chinese language is finding its way in Africa. Find out why after the break.
Hello, listener of South Sudan in Focus. We have an exciting new segment dubbed Words of Wisdom. We want to hear your thoughtful proverbs that echo through your community. This is another chance for you to share wisdom from your roots. All you need to do is record a proverb in a language of your choice, tell us its English translation and what it means. Keep it brief, authentic, and represent your community. Your recorded proverb shall be sampled on South Sudan in Focus every Wednesday. send your recording via our WhatsApp number, +1 202 630 8011. That is +1 202 630 8011.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. And I will repeat, our number is +1 202 630 8011. If you send your proverb, we shall sample them every Wednesday. And our words of wisdom for this Wednesday comes from Kajokeji County in Central Equatorial State.
This is Ronyo Charles John again from Central Equatoria State, Juba, Kajokeji County, Kuku by Tribe. I'm coming with the second phase of a Kuku proverb, which states that Tomelo Tongo Kokolo Iloin. In English, it is stating that every elephant is burdened by its task. This means that everybody has to carry his own load in order to be successful. Don't ever say that I need somebody to help me to carry my burden, but you have to carry your own task. This one is a very important proverb in our Kuku tribe. Thank you.
And indeed, I'm carrying my own task here in the studio. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. China's Confucius Institutes teach Chinese around the world, but there is more to that. Kate Bartlett visited a new one that is hundreds of kilometers outside the capital in rural South Africa that is also focusing on green technology.
OK, 很好,很好, 请看手机, yeah, that's it, OK, 请坐, wow!
These South African students are learning a new skill. Chililo Kotisi is one of the students here learning Mandarin.
In Chinese, we say, which means learning Chinese is amazing.
Mandarin is taught here at the University of Venda. It's one of the hundreds of Confucius Institutes set up by China around the world, some 60 of which are in Africa. But this one, which opened its doors earlier this year, is slightly different from the institutes in Johannesburg and Cape Town. University of Venda is in a far-flung rural area of the country. Chung Zhou is a Confucius Institute teacher.
The Green Technology Confucius Institute, they at first step, we focus on the Chinese language teaching. And then when we combine the Chinese language with the green technology, like the engineer or some solar, yes. So when they can say some Chinese words fluently, then they can go to China for a further study to gain more knowledge about to the technology or green technology.
To set up the institute, the University of Venda partnered with Hubei University of Technology in China, says University of Venda's Thabo Dikale.
The Chinese government is contributing handsomely to this initiative.
Confucius Institutes are one way China builds strategic influence in a country, says China analyst Paul Nantulia.
These Confucius Institutes blend very much with the strategic priorities of the host countries. So they're doing much more than just language training. So in Venda, as we mentioned, South Africa is in an energy crisis, and therefore it's trying to provide a solution, which is green technology, to see how that might be developed and to build that capacity, which is one of the strategic priorities of the South African government.
But in many Western countries, Confucius Institutes are seen as propaganda machines. In recent years, most US universities have closed their Confucius Institutes due to government pressure, including potential loss of federal funding. Some European countries have also shut down Confucius Institutes. Concerns include institutes interfering with academic freedoms and even faculty self-censorship of taboo Chinese political topics. But South African universities are not worried. Dekale says the students will decide for themselves.
They will have their own independent thought around politics and what's happening, globally. What we are trying to do is expose them to different worlds, for them to make their own decisions around what's right, what's sound, politically or otherwise.
China is South Africa's biggest trading partner, and students hope Chinese language skills will give them an edge when it comes to the job market. Chililo Kotisi is one of the students here.
I'm studying international relation, and Chinese is one of the UN languages, so it's really wanted up there.
With high unemployment levels in the country, many of these students share his belief. Some 300 students have already enrolled in the Mandarin classes. Kate Bartlett, VOA News, Tayondo, Limpopo Province, South Africa.
From issues to do with science and maths, I must admit, maths was not my best subject because my maths teacher was not my friend. But regardless, that's not the end of the world. Let's now go for some space news. Esteemed American astronomer, geoscience professor and artist Shane Proctor is touring South African schools to emphasize the importance of education, science, technology, engineering, arts, and mathematics. Her goal is to inspire students to pursue careers in science and equip them for space jobs. Zahir Kasim reports from Johannesburg.
Cyan Proctor always dreamed of being an astronaut. In 2009, she became a finalist for the U.S. space agency NASA astronaut program, but didn't get the job. Proctor, a geology professor and artist, never gave up on her space dreams. In 2021, she was chosen to participate in SpaceX's Inspiration 4, the first all-civilian orbital mission. She became the first black woman to pilot a spacecraft.
Going to space and on a SpaceX Dragon capsule and being the mission pilot is the most rewarding and inspiring thing I could ever think of. To be able to say that I'm a Dragon flyer, and for, you know, girls and women of color to see me and know that if I did it, they could do it too.
Late last month, she was in Johannesburg, South Africa, speaking to over 250 high school students about the importance of science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, or STEM, when pursuing a profession in space exploration. She says another subject is also crucial for would-be astronauts.
My art in space project.
But we got to add the arts in because that's the creative side. You can't have science without creativity and imagination because that's where the innovation comes. And so it's really important that we inspire, prepare, and eventually employ students to go into these areas.
The space sector is expanding rapidly, yet companies face challenges in recruiting due to the high demand for STEM skills. Space agencies in the United States, United Kingdom, and South Africa have all reported a shortage of qualified personnel. Exposure to real-life role models can help address this issue, says Steve Sherman, head of the education nonprofit Living Maths, which helped arrange Proctor's visit.
We want them to know how exciting a career can be if they interact with these people who actually use math and science and technology in their careers. If they can see how awesome it is, then hopefully they'll be more engaged.
Many in the country don't know space careers exist, says South African National Space Agency educator Ntabiseng Lebaka.
I had no idea that South Africa is a space agency. They were looking for a science educator. So I'm currently working as a science engagement officer, where we do outreach programs, we do space clubs, we also do teacher development training as well.
Proctor then took a mission to Cape Town, where she shares her inspirational journey to promote education in STEM subjects and the arts. Sayed Kasim, VOA News, Johannesburg, South Africa.
From matters to do with mathematics, we go to politics, where the two U.S. presidential tickets are set. Vice President Kamala Harris named her running mate Tuesday, but the presumed Democratic Party nominee wasn't alone making news in one of America's oldest cities, Philadelphia, in the northeastern state of Pennsylvania. That's where we find VOA's senior Washington correspondent Caroline Presutti.
In a town where the founding fathers declared independence, Philadelphia on Tuesday showing off the peaks of democracy with both political parties. For the first time, Vice President Kamala Harris, the presumptive Democratic presidential nominee, introduces her running mate, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz.
Tim and I have a message for Trump and others who want to turn back the clock on our fundamental freedoms. We're not going back.
Army soldier turned high school teacher turned football coach turned politician. Walz directly attacked the Republican ticket.
Just an observation of mine that I made. I just have to say it. You know it. You feel it. These guys are creepy and, yes, just weird as hell. That's what you see. That's what you see.
Some Democrats say Walz will bring back former Trump Democrats from swing states.
I think that that's a core demographic that Harris campaign will have to win. And I think, Tim, that really speaks to those voters.
Just a few hours prior, on the other side of town,
and she ought to answer for the fact.
The other side, Republican vice presidential nominee J.D. Vance held his own rally with a unique twist, answering questions from the media.
Let's talk a little bit about foreign policy.
And with some sharp words for Harris's running mate.
Tim Walz's record is a joke. He's been one of the most far-left radicals in the entire United States government at any level.
Vance struck out at Democrats on immigration, fentanyl, and the economy, calling the stock market drop the Kamala crash. Undecided voter Wayne Eastman carried Vance's memoir as he stood in line to see the rally.
It's unusual to have a politician who's a writer, too, so, curious.
In 90 days, U.S. voters will make the decision between a former president and a current vice president. But the Harris team is pushing a chant to avoid a Trump repeat. From here, the Harris-Walz team visits five more battleground states in the next 5 days. Wisconsin, Michigan, North Carolina, Arizona, and Nevada. Carolyn Pursuti, VOA News, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
And that report from Pennsylvania brings us to the end of this show for this Wednesday, August 7, 2024. We now leave politics aside and we go for music, this time around with the song Sambala Sambala by a group calling itself Genesis the Veteran. Listening to Genesis the Veteran and the song Sambala Sambala I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer, Jumbe Hamza, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Better for King Wolf to some balance.